A New Zealand author, journalist and media educator who has covered the Asia-Pacific region for more than two decades says liberation must come for Kanaki New Caledonia. Professor Roby sailed on board Greenpeace's flagship Rainbow Warrior until it was bombed by French secret agents in New Zealand. He has been arrested at gunpoint in New Caledonia and accused also of being a spy. The now director of Asia Pacific Report told Lydia Lewis France is torpedoing any hopes of Kanaki independence. Professor Roby spoke with Lydia Lewis, who began by asking him for his take of the riots so far.
It's a real tragedy because, you know, we had something like 35 years of building up goodwill since the 1980s when I was as a journalist covering what they called Les Événements, where it was basically almost a civil war and dozens of people died during that period. And then we had the Matignon Accord came in 1988 and then the Noumea Accord 10 years later. And there was gradual building up of goodwill between those who support independence and those who are absolutely opposed to it. And you have the situation right now where, in fact, politically, for the first time, the government, the territorial government of New Caledonia is actually dominated by the pro-independence groups. And the president himself, Louis Mapu, he's pro-independence. And that's really the first time in the territorial government's happened. So it's caught everybody by absolute shock. It's going to be really hard. You think that 35 years just being wiped away like that in a few days. And it's going to be a huge challenge for France because basically, as far as I see it, France has betrayed the aspirations of the indigenous Kanak people. It's a self-listed under the United Nations as a territory to be decolonized. And the whole spirit of the Noumea Accord was to lead towards self-determination. And I think that progress has been made quite well with the first two votes on self-determination, the two referendums on independence, where there's a slight opposition, which narrowed in the second one, but the third one was a complete write-off because it was after COVID. You had a massive number of Indigenous Kanaks who died during that period. From 2020 onwards, basically France lost the plot. It's had three prime ministers now since 2020. None of them seem to have any real affinity for indigenous issues, particularly in the South Pacific, in contrast to some previous prime ministers. So we've got a devastation, really, of this this last week. It seems also, of course, that it's very different from back in the 1980s, where all the protests and demonstrations and so on were very well organised by the FNKS, the Kanak and Socialist National Liberation Front. This time, in the last week, it's been spontaneous. Like the protests began as usual legitimate protests, then they became violent and destruction and that sort of thing. And it's been spontaneous young people that have actually sort of done this. So it's going to be a challenge for basically for everybody. It's a challenge for French government to rebuild trust for a start. It's going to be a challenge for the FNKS to regain trust from the those that are opposed to independence, and also a challenge for the those who are opposed to independence, because essentially, liberation must come. You know, I mean, it's been the history all over the world that people that are colonized eventually. They achieve their aspirations and become independent. And I thought that France was actually on the right page over the last, just prior to this last 3 years, making progress. And then they just basically sort of effectively, I think, sabotaged the process, really. They weighed in very heavily with the anti-colonial forces. And I think the Kanak people felt they've lacked respect, the French government's lacked respect, and they're just simply not listening to them.
Charles Weir told me last week, we don't want to be like the Māori in New Zealand. We don't want to be like the Aboriginal people in Australia. And his reasoning for that was he doesn't want to be a minority in his own country. Mm. But aren't Kanaks already a minority in their own country?
Yes, they are. They are. But the demographics, the way, like, I mean, this is where the goodwill was brought in the Noumea Accords in 1998. France brought in that the only people could participate in New Caledonian elections as opposed to the the French state as a whole, were indigenous Kanaks, and those who've been living in New Caledonia prior to 1998. The indigenous Kanaks are still in a minority compared with that other group. There's a pretty close parity in a way, and also to bear in mind a lot of French people who've lived in New Caledonia for a long time believe in independence as well. And so there was a chance. But now, under this constitutional, I won't call it a reform, and I know a lot of media call it a reform. I think it's a very retrograde step, and this is the problem, because France has said, well, with its constitutional change, which isn't yet law, although the National Assembly voted fairly decisively for it, there still has to be a combined vote.
That one last step still.
Yes. And a lot can happen, because they're obviously going to put that off for quite some time and try to get some kind of consensus happening. But what it means is you've got something like, for those who've been in New Caledonia for 10 years can vote. And so I don't know the exact number, but most figures seem to be being put out, 25,000 extra French voters. And those who are supporting or against independence say, well, this is democracy, you know, one person, one vote. But of course, it doesn't work in an indigenous environment like this, you see, and particularly when it's not a self-government, like it's supposed to be ultimately an independent nation. French people can vote in France anytime, like it's part of their democratic right. But it's a rather different situation in New Caledonia. So when you've got another 25,000, I've seen figures as up to as many as 40,000, then included in the vote, both in any future referendums or in the local provincial governments and the territorial governments, that's going to completely swamp Indigenous people.
Is this a deliberate step to erode and to wipe out the Indigenous vote in New Caledonia?
Well, my personal view is yes, absolutely. I think that that's what's happened, because I think previous prime ministers, and I mentioned, I think, Edouard Philippe, who was prime minister from 2017 to 2020, really had a good feeling for New Caledonia. And I think he was rather, you know, looked upon with both from both sides with a lot of respect and so on. But then the prime minister changed, and we've had three prime ministers since then, and none of them seem to have really got the plot, really. And then the crucial thing was that after Philippe was moved to another portfolios and so on, the final referendum came in 2021. Now, the trajectory up until then, the two previous referendums, was there's a growing percentage for independence. Not quite as both the two previous ones were over 50% against, but the second one was higher for independence, and that, like, there'd been a rise. There was a very good chance that they could have got a yes vote for that third referendum. But what happened was, with the COVID, you had thousands of Kanaks dying, and under customary law and so on, or customary the protocols and so on, mourning is in indigenous tribes in New Caledonia. It's a year's mourning. And there's no way that the FNKS or other political groups were going to be able to mount campaigns and so on before that referendum. So they appealed. They appealed for a delay. They were turned down, and they weren't even really listened to at all. And then they made an appeal, I think it was to the Constitutional Court in France, and that was rejected on, you know, the sort of democracy grounds, you know, sort of thing, quote unquote. And so basically they had nowhere to then turn. So from then on, I think the FNKS weren't going to sort of cooperate at all with negotiations about the future. And also they insisted that the vote on changes to the constitutional rules for voting in New Caledonia would be after there'd been a consensus. So, hopefully worked towards a consensus among the leadership of all the political groups. That consultation never happened. So it's sort of been railroaded in my view. And I think it's, you know, like it's really an intention to block any real prospect of self-determination. And I think the reason why France did this was they thought, well, it's sufficiently, the no vote was sufficiently strong, just over the 50%, but it was enough to justify basically torpedoing any future hope of the Canucks.
And this all needs to be wrapped up by the end of this year. It all needs to be, it's my understanding that they need to get it finished by the end of this year. Talks need to happen by the end of this year. What possible steps towards independence could be taken? I mean, we're talking about negotiations here, parties getting together, but on the legal front, in terms of, you know, proposals and, you know, the Noumea Accord, what are the possibilities to work towards independence or not?
Well, my personal view is that they should scrap this proposed
Is that
withdrawal.
Possible, though?
It is anything, yes. It hasn't gone through the full process yet, but it'd have to have the goodwill and the vision. I think the vision is needed, because otherwise there's a pretty dire prospect in the future. Otherwise, it'll be like a situation of trying to retain control by force rather than goodwill and consensus. But I believe that there are moves to have a mission go out to New Caledonia, and the names that are being mentioned for this, probably a group of leaders, but two people in particular have been named that I think is very interesting, and that is Edouard Philippe, the former Prime Minister that I mentioned before, who seemed to have a good handle on New Caledonian affairs. And then another one, Lionel Jospin, who was Prime Minister at the time of the Noumea Accord. So he was a central figure in the drafting of that accord. So whether both of them or one or the other might be part of this group, mainly because I think that they realised that there would be a bit of trust, certainly among the more established leaders among the pro-independence Kanak groups, and probably well-respected among the anti-independence as well, because what really is needed now is some kind of consensus.
So could goodwill come from these former, you know, leaders who, like you say, have previously had goodwill? Could they have a hand here in peaceful negotiations and, you know, a role in, you know, pushing France or suggesting to France to scrap this?
I think it is. I think it'd be a very positive move. Certainly it needs some energy like that to try, because I'd say that New Caledonia now is more polarised than ever. I mean, sad, really sad, because, you know, think of 30 years, 35 years if you take it right back to the Montagnol Accord, but it's really 3 decades of hard work by a lot of people to build a sort of like a future for New Caledonia, which is part of the Pacific rather than part of France, you know. So it's hopeful that something like that will happen. Certainly it has to be some kind of charismatic change in sort of the way things are at the moment, you know.
And Pacific leaders, could they also play a role in this? They've come out, you know, they've said that a big reason as to, you know, having French territories as part of the Pacific family is a movement towards independence. So what role could Pacific leaders play, particularly with the upcoming Pacific Islands Forum, in supporting that, or, you know, speaking to France even?
Yes, well, and also most civil society groups have been calling for the scrapping of this, you know, constitutional change, because that's really the source of the problems. And it's important to remember that both New Caledonia, and I like to call it Kanaka New Caledonia, because that's really a recognition, just as we call Aotearoa New Zealand.
Should we, as media, be calling it Kanaki New Caledonia?
In my view, yes, and I do routinely in my media.
Why should we be doing that if it's not recognised sort of at a higher level as that?
Well, it is recognised in the sense that it's been a customary up until now, just the same as the Kanak flag is flown alongside the French tricolour. You know, it's a very similar similar sort of thing. And it's like in New Zealand, it's informal that we refer to Aotearoa New Zealand. And some media do, including me.
You mentioned briefly, you've been reporting on this for decades. Can you take me back to the days when you were on the ground? And I even read that you were arrested. Can you take me back to those volatile days that you were reporting?
Yeah. Well, as a journalist, I was freelance in those days, but reporting for a lot of media around the Pacific. And reporting, I think, from a Pacific perspective rather than necessarily New Zealand or Australian, although I was reporting for Radio Australia and also RNZ. Thank you. RNZ's great. And I was also reporting for Pacific Islands Monthly and Islands Business and a number of other publications as well. So it's always seeing the region from the Pacific perspective and how New Caledonia fits into that. I made a number of trips to New Caledonia during that period. And I did get arrested twice, in fact, but the first time was actually at gunpoint, which was slightly unnerving, because I knew what were they arresting me for. They accused me of being a spy. This was over in a village called Canala. It was during the actual protests, the Les Evenements, and I was in Canala at the time when there was a leader that got assassinated eventually, and he basically had an axe, and I got a photograph of him with this axe on his shoulders, but I didn't know what was going to happen. Eloy Mushiro was his name, and he was just going off. This was during a referendum that was being boycotted at the time by the FNKS supporters, and he was just going off to the polling booth in Canala, and unfortunately I missed this actual moment, but I got him just before it was happening with this axe, and this photograph has been used quite widely around the world. And what he planned to do was chop open the ballot box, and they burnt all the ballot paper. So this was highly symbolic of the resistance by the pro-independence people, as it will. France hated him. He was the Minister of Security with the FNKS at the time, whereas, of course, from Paris's point of view, they saw him as the Minister of Insecurity. So he had a target on his back, and eventually he was actually killed by snipers. By profession, he was a school teacher. And he's just really thrust into this role during the uprising at the time. Mostly it was a series of skirmishes. There were blockades all over Grande Terre, which is the main island and so on, and also in the Loyalty Islands as well. And there were skirmishes, but there were a number of assassinations. Mostly it was very, very, we talk about heavy-handed French response at the moment. It was far, far more heavy-handed back then. In fact, I just can't quite remember the figures now, but there's the French military combined, the military, gendarmerie and police at that time were higher number than, say, New Zealand's armed forces. And you think, well, what was the population? Now, the population of New Caledonia today is around about 270,000, according to the 2019 census. But of course, it was a lot smaller then. So I think it's a highly militarised.
And around anyway, 30 deaths as well.
I didn't tell you why I was actually arrested, why I was accused of being a spy. Well, I'd read in news magazines in France, because, it was very well covered by the French journalists all the time, about the militarisation of small villages all around New Caledonia, mainly on the east coast and so on. And they were using a technique that was used in Algeria in the War of Independence there, what they called nomadization, which means you put in a garrison in the village, and then the soldiers go out at night and bang on the doors of homes and basically terrorize the community. And it's all about intimidation, basically keep the indigenous people quiet and that sort of thing. And I'd read about this and I thought, oh, this is a very good story for a reason. I hadn't read anything about it in any of the English language media. So I thought, well, that's one of my missions. That particular trip, I'd go and report about this. So I went to Canala and I had a Kanaka official with me from the local territorial government in Noumea. He was sort of my guide in a sense, but he was driving, I sort of took photographs. We went past one of these nomadization outposts, the military set up and so on, and of course I just took photographs. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that because it had been done already by French journalists. And next thing, it was a roadblock set up just down the road. And there were soldiers there, and this officer came straight up to me, and he said, "Monsieur Irby," and so on. And yes, I mean, they arrested me on the spot. But what I did was change my cameras. I had a camera around my neck, and I had another camera, and I quickly changed the camera and so on. And they seized the film. So they took me to the gendarmerie, and I was handed over to the gendarmes. The military handed me over to the gendarmes and so on. And then they got out statute books and so on, that sort of thing, and there was sort of reference to being a spy, which was ridiculous, but it's still pretty unnerving from a journalist's point of view. You're not quite sure what's going to happen there. And they refused to allow me to phone the New Zealand consulate in Noumea at the time. But it was all just intimidating. But the funny thing, I have to tell you about this, funny thing was, we were separated. The guy who was with me, he's driving, and he's the official, actually, you know, a part of the officials of the local government and so on. He was put in one room, and I was put in another room. And they questioned both of us separately, and I can't put this guy in all sorts of trouble. He might lose his job or something like that, you know. And so I'm sort of telling the interviewers and so on, well, I just got picked up, you know, I'm just a freelancer, I'm just picked up, and this guy gave me a lift, you see. And he's telling me, we've known him for a long time, he's one of our journalists.
You'd think you'd get your story straight
We didn't have a chance, you see, and of course...
What context can you give to Charles Weir's, you know, quote that he doesn't want his people to be like Māori and Aotearoa or First Nation peoples in Australia?
Yes. Well, I think the comparison is much more with Australia rather than, I mean, Aotearoa New Zealand is probably the better aspects of what we have is more of an example of what could be in New Caledonia. But you have to recall that New Caledonia began life just like the colonial life, just like Australia, penal colony. They shipped off, Algerian fighters for independence. They shipped off Vietnamese fighters during the Vietnam War. And some of the other minorities, because a lot of people realise that they think, it's French and Kanak. It's not. It's a lot more mixed than that, a lot more complicated, in that many of the earlier people have had this backgrounds of the struggles, but they identify often with France. So it's much more of a comparison with Australia, in that France had the attitude of there's no respect for the indigenous values and so on. There were executions. In fact, I mean, we ran something just the other day about marking the execution of 10 people resisting, Kanak people resisting French control a century and a half ago, and they were executed by the guillotine, and there's a memorial for them. That was just being honoured at the weekend. We have the Te Riti, that sets quite a big difference. There's no equivalent to that in New Caledonia. But I think what probably Charles Weir is referring to is that honouring of Indigenous aspirations and values that New Zealand has, but it's also referring to the dispossession of land, a dispossession of culture and language and so on as well, even though there's been a lot of progress made over the last 50, 70 years or so in Aotearoa New Zealand.
That's right. And also some Kanaki locals told me when I was there last month that they're terrified of their culture being ripped away from them, that their children don't want to learn one of their many languages, because there are many languages. Just like Te Reo Māori and Aotearoa. They've got many languages, and they only learn two of the languages in schools, but the kids would just rather learn French or English. So that's a very real, fear for the current Was there anything that I missed? Like always, I always do long interviews, so I like listening to you, but I mean...
Well, look, I'll just raise one comment, because I was in touch with a politician, a Kanak politician that I know who's... she's a former journalist too, but anyway, I've known her for quite a few years, and she's she travels a lot internationally as well. But she just made this comment to me. She said, well, France have shown their true face. The Kanak people are seen as the enemy. And I hope that's a rather depressing thought, but I hope it's not going to be like that. I really hope that France listens and realizes it has to change track. It has to have a consensus. And that's what was being built over the previous, you know, three decades that I mentioned. So hopefully there's a real positive rethink now on their policies, because certainly militarization, even if it may be needed right at this moment to restore law and order and so on, is not the way to go for the future.
Does the media play a role, particularly in Aotearoa, in projecting this view?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I think that I think it's a very important issue. New Caledonia is our closest neighbour. It's 3 hours, 3 hours away on a flight, and yet the media basically ignores it. Except, you know, as a tourist destination and so on. And of course, if you go there as a tourist, you see this white city, this affluent white city, and you don't really get a sense of the tribu out there.
It's Europe that's 2 hours away.
Yes. Unfortunately, I've felt this for a long time, that New Zealand media, they regard the Pacific as really the Polynesian triangle. They a little bit in Micronesia and a little bit in Melanesia. And in many ways, the economic... the most important economic countries, in a sense, partly because of that politically, are Papua New Guinea, New Caledonia, Vanuatu, and Fiji, of course. Well, Fiji gets really good coverage. But we've had the skewed concentration on parts of the Pacific because we have the diaspora here, the large diasporas, but we've more or less ignored those other countries. And so when something like this happens, this last week, all these riots, why are there riots, you know? Whereas if we had more systematic reporting, and I know, I really acknowledge RNZ Pacific, because you did a fantastic job. I'm really talking about the mainstream media outside of RNZ Pacific at the moment. We just don't get a sense of that. And I mean, look at the Herald. I mean, for 2 days, they didn't have anything on this crisis at all, and then they did over the next couple of days, but they relied on your stories. And I thought, well, you've got the biggest reporting team in the country, what are they doing? But you see, the thing is that if you have journalists going, as like Walter Zeifel for RNZ, regularly went to New Caledonia before and interviewed lots of people and so on, and we've got Patrick now, and you know, that it builds up a sort of a knowledge over a period of time. And so when something happens big, it's easy just to shift key a bit and follow up those leads and the contacts that we have. If the other media are not doing that, they don't know who to contact, and then, well, language might be a barrier there, because they concentrate, I think, too much on the tourists, but and a lot of other people who don't really know what's going on. And so you only just get a sort of like a half pie coverage of the crisis, how it's affecting New Zealanders, which is very important, of course, and Australians in the same boat sort of thing. But we don't really get an understanding of what are the deeper issues, why is this happening, and what are the hopes for the future.
And does that also project the Indigenous population as the bad guys?
Yes, I think it's a projection that basically, oh, well, they're young people, I would expect that they're actually sort of looting and causing fires and that sort of thing. They don't get an appreciation of just how absolutely frustrated young people feel. It's 50% of unemployment as a result of the nickel industry collapse, you know.
And a major divide of poverty and, you know, affluence as well.
Yes, exactly. So all this has sort of played into it. And there's been a lot of references that the leadership of the FNKS have lost control of the youth. But you have to weigh that up against this absolute frustration that's gone on for years. Because even though I've probably given a little bit of a positive view of the political changes over three decades before the last 3 years, but not a lot has been done to change the economic disparities. In fact, they've got worse probably in those years.
One comparison, well, I'd like to know if you think we can draw a comparison, is the wording used by the French government. Back then, Kanaks were called terrorists, and now strong words have been used in the finger-pointing game.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Well, I'm glad you raised that too, because I think they've made... They've made the CCAT, the field groups that are not the official independence parties by any means, but of course they have an association. And people like Christian Tien and so on, a leader, quite a charismatic leader, and others, they've made them scapegoats. They put all the blame on them, and that's not the reason. You know, like, I don't believe that those leaders actually had intended all this to unfold over the last couple of weeks. It's sort of like once the protests reached a level of anger and frustration, it just sort of all hell broke loose, you know. But they have been made the scapegoats, whereas the real culprits are the French government, and particularly the last three prime ministers, in my view.